Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, everyone. This is the Sound Health Option Show with Richard Talk to Me Guy, and Sherry Edwards is off in the lab developing software and working on the new portal. That's going to be very exciting, as that's happening now. I've been on it, and it is really a blast to not have to have all that software on your computer. It's amazing. Today, we're going to be speaking with Anthony Chirillo. It's actually an interview Sherry and I did earlier this week. As we all know, the holiday schedule changes everything. And it's a really great, well, I'll just get into it. It's a really great interview, and even if you're in your 30s, this is relevant. This is really great information, really useful for the aging experience and the patient care experience. It's really excellent. Anthony Chirillo is the very well expert in senior care and on the executive board of CCAL, the Consumer Consortium for Person-Centered Living. A member and workgroup co-chair of the Dementia Action Alliance, he knows the ins and outs of healthcare delivery. There are almost 40 million people aged 65 plus in the United States. America's 50 and older population will reach 100 million this year. Anthony Chirillo is a passionate advocate for these caregivers and seniors, helping them lead a quality of life through a platform of educated aging, physically, emotionally, and financially. Anthony shares his knowledge with consumers in many ways. His site, theagingexperience.com, and corresponding video blogs help consumers understand the healthcare system while imparting ways to live a quality life. TheAgingExperience.com is listed as one of the top boomer blogs by Alltop and feeds to other health sites, including Dr. Oz's ShareCare. His book, entitled Who Moved My Dentures, helps dispel myths about aging. Anthony joins us today to talk about his bestseller, Who Moved My Dentures, and his goal to put the care back in patient experience and healthcare. Here we go.
Anthony, I'd like to start by asking, I read your bio, your resume, a bunch of information on your site. Wow. And B, what was your journey from TV production to such a strong passion for healthcare with a really amazing focus on elder care that then you became an entertainer in that world? Wow. How did that
work? Well, some of it was parallel. So let's just say I've been an entertainer for most of my life before I knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. So, you know, I was playing in bands in nightclubs when I was underage, you know, like 14 and 15 years old, but been playing guitar since I was 10 years old. So I always had the music thing, and then kind of discovered that I could sing through a friend of ours who was in the band, he was the keyboard player. His mother kind of caught me singing harmony one day. And when the lead singer left the band, she said, I think you might have something there. And so that was that. So my college background was a business degree. And I kind of, really wasn't enamored with going into business per se. And with being in a band, I also had little time to get involved in school, and I finally just took some time and I became the sports editor for the newspaper at Drexel University. And that actually helped me to get an internship at the local CBS station. And I parlayed that into a job for the CBS radio network, producing a radio show, I should say, that aired three mornings a week on the national CBS radio network. And, but there was no money in radio production either. So, I kind of left there and got a job in medical publishing kind of keeping with kind of writing media kind of background. And somehow or another, those two things, and you know, I wanted to, the reason I didn't stay in media is I didn't want to go to some other market, you know, a small town, because I'm from Philadelphia. I'm used to kind of big city living, and my family was all there. And plus, I had so many music connections and was, you know, eventually did go on to play in the casinos in Atlantic City and things like that. So, you know, so TV and radio as a full-time career really wasn't in my brain. Music kind of outweighed that. It's interesting now that I'm doing much more media work. But those two, somebody saw in me, and that's what I counsel some of my, you know, when I mentor people, I tell them that, you know, my first job, somebody saw something that I didn't see, and that was they saw that I had a media background, which they figured I had media connections, which was pretty true. And I also had this medical publishing background, so they figured I could write. And also could understand and deal with physicians. And they hired me as a director of corporate communications when I was like 26, a hospital in Philadelphia, which, you know, kind of led to another hospital and led to, you know, going to New York and help launch a company. So that's kind of the long answer, but music was always a parallel. And then the healthcare kind of started organically, and the music kind of led to the senior mission, which I, you know, can certainly tell you about.
And are you, I think a critical question is, you're Italian, you're from the East Coast. So are you a Sinatra crooner or are you a headbanger?
Well, you know, so if people go on my website, theagingexperience.com, and go under my products and CDs, there's music samples. And what you're going to hear there are typically, you know, so kind of let's continue the conversation. The reason I got involved in elder care, so I was in healthcare, but I was not in elder care, was when I got out of nightclubs and bands and I wanted to do something else with my musical talent. I walked into a nursing home one day and started performing for seniors. And when I left Philadelphia, I was literally doing 100 performances a year, and I was becoming an entertainer. I wasn't just a guy who played in a band who happened to, you know, he sang and played bass guitar. I was actually becoming a real entertainer, and it kind of transformed my life in the fact that I was having an impact on people and they were having an impact on me. So when you go to my site and you see CDs and samples, you're going to hear more of what you just said, which is the Sinatra, the standards and all those types of things. But my repertoire is just crazy, you know, variety. I go anywhere from the Sinatra, you know, and Cole Porter and all that, to singing Bruno Mars, you know, and Train and the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac. In fact, I open my, I spoke in Illinois recently, and I opened my my speech with a Bruno Mars song. You know, the one goes, when I see your face, there's not a thing that I would change. You're amazing just the way you are. And I have a collage of people who are in the audience that I kind of got from LinkedIn. And they're looking at their faces while I'm singing the song, and they make all kind of interesting connections about, well, first of all, he's starting with the song. That could be an awkward moment, unless then they realize, well, wait a minute, he can actually sing. And then, wait a minute, I'm in that picture. Why am I in that picture? And I make a point, basically, that in my healthcare work, that no matter what their role in the organization are, they're the face of the patient experience. So I use song, and my repertoire is crazy.
I was going to say, I've never heard, I don't think I've ever heard Sinatra and Bruno Mars in the same sentence before.
Probably haven't, but there you go. Yeah, it's all over the place.
I love the picture on the Aging Experience, these ladies in the band. They're rocking on.
Well, absolutely. That was some serendipity there, you know, frankly. So my company used to be called Fast Forward Consulting, and I was a marketing, you know, a healthcare consultant to hospitals in the area of marketing, and then kind of got some thought leadership in patient experience because of some things I wrote that resulted in, you know, kind of a movement being started in that area. And but I always had this parallel senior thing going on, and I had three separate websites to do three separate things. And I finally just said, you know, I'm going to own this, period. And I'm going to rebrand, and it's going to be one site, and it's going to be one place, and it's going to be called the aging experience, because while I have some thought leadership and patient experience that involves hospitals and things like that, frankly, there's a lot of people in that space. And if you go to healthcare marketing or marketing in general, there's a ton of people in that space, but there's few people who can kind of combine this idea of customer experience, marketing, media, writing, and connect the dots amongst the whole continuum of healthcare, whether it's hospitals or long-term care or family caregivers. And so, you know, I picked the aging experience because it's something I know nobody else really owns, and I've trademarked it because I come to find that out. And so the picture was pure serendipity. I was hunting around Getty Images. I used to write for what was called About.com, and I was the senior health expert. And you know, we got access to use photos in Getty, but so you know, I'm always looking at photos, and I found this group of grannies. And the funny part, Sherry, is people think, they ask me if that's a real group, and I say, well, you have to really look at it close because it's the same woman in the picture. And so she's, you know, they photoshopped her playing all these instruments. And so I said, you know, that's my brand. It's me. I'm a rock and roll guy, and I sing, and I believe that you have to rock the aging experience, which what I mean is you have to live your life fully and with a positive attitude and a quality of life at all stages of your life. And so it fit perfectly. And then the tagline was, again, pure luck. I had been I've been really struggling with a tagline for months, and I was writing, you know, as people tend to do, you overwrite, and I was writing sentences, you know, of what it is I thought I was. And then I said, wait a minute. I said, you know, Nike has Just Do It. I'm just going to have Just Rock It. And I looked, you know, we trademarked that as well because nobody's using it in that kind of context. So, you know, and really it's a great segue in terms of, you know, establish with, you know, in my mission with seniors.
Well, it's an amazing, you know, what, in reading the book, your book, Who Moved My Dentures? I mean, your sense of, at first when I read your parts of your site, I had a judgment at the very beginning, just looking at thinking, oh, you know, here's another bureaucrat, you know, another expert, you know, somebody who's been in a big organization tells people how to, you know, do the business part. But as you read the book and you get further into your story, you see that you have all that experience. That's all true. And yet you also have this other really caring part for, you know, us becoming conscious about aging, being okay with aging, and then you really move into the care of people in the care facilities, or as we get older, how do we, you know, the development, all that. And it's really, it's a real passion that I, you know, really have a lot of respect for. You know, it's an amazing journey to get to, you know, really the aging experience is a positive event.
No, you're absolutely right, and thank you for your feedback on that, because, you know, on one hand, I do have to make a living, and I do that by consulting with, you know, health organizations around, you know, the experience of care and strategic marketing, but really now trying to get them to, you know, think about becoming dementia friendly, and I talk about that in several different ways. As I was telling a group yesterday, I talk about it from the employee experience, about looking at caregivers in the workplace through a different lens, because, you know, most organizations probably don't even know that they have 6 out of 10 employees are, you know, family caregivers, or becoming dementia friendly or leading dementia friendly initiatives in their community. So I do have to absolutely make a living, you know, so I can support the mission, because what I'm finding is I grow older too, is that, you know, I'm getting more, you know, and this might just be an angry old guy speaking now, but I'm getting angrier at the health system, because I've been so exposed to, perspectives from around the world. I've been, you know, really fortunate to speak in other countries and see how things work. I'm really on top of what's going on with dementia care in other countries. And I think, you know, the U.S. clinically, I mean, we're probably way ahead of others, but when it comes to what they call the social determinants and the advocacy and all these types of things is we're kind of behind because, you know, as we talk about an organization I belong to called the Dementia Action Alliance, you know, it's great that there's a lot of interest in the cure for Alzheimer's, but until there is one, just like with diabetes or congestive heart failure, there's no cures. And so we have to live well with this disease we have. And how do we help people do that? And I'm finding, you know, I'm just getting more passionate around the advocacy. I'm really, you know, getting, you know, the whole way of payment in this country, you know, was never addressed with the Affordable Care Act, and whether or not we still have that when it's all said and done, it's going to actually have a huge difference in senior health. But it was never meant to address cost, and nobody is addressing how do you pay for, you know, your long-term care. And, you know, I went to an open house for a new assisted living here. I live in the Charlotte area now, Charlotte, North Carolina. And, you know, it was a beautiful facility and the people were nice and they were caring and you could tell all that. And but you get to the price tag and you're looking for people to pay anywhere. And this is probably low for you out where you folks live, you know, anywhere from $5,000 to $8,000 a month. Now people who are, you know, even if they made a good living when they, you know, were working and have assets, you know, you can quickly go through a lot of money because this is not reimbursed by insurance. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize, you know, just how all this is paid for. And so I'm finding as my brand develops, I'm becoming more of an advocate, but really am now trying to see how do I kind of put it all together to have real movement in the healthcare industry because, you know, the providers really do have to change, not to get off on a soapbox here a little bit and you know, stop me as you will, but I spoke to an assisted living organization association a few weeks ago, and you know, these were administrators in assisted living, and you know, I was trying to paint the whole picture of elder care, that it's not just what goes on in their four walls, but it's what happens outside, what happens in the community, how do we become dementia friendly, you know, odd bedfellows in terms of helping us to identify people who might have dementia, like bank tellers who, you know, when the first lines, when they identify people messing up their checkbooks. And I was trying to just paint a more holistic picture for them. And so I was citing some pop culture examples. I said, like, you know, when the movie Still Alice came out, I said, you know, I went to see it because I was really interested in how, you know, this woman was going to be portrayed. And I asked them in the audience, how many went to see it? And only 5% of the audience raised their hand. And then I asked them, you know, had anyone been through any kind of aging simulation? And, you know, the one I cite is from a friend of mine. Her name's PK Bevel. She has a group called Second Wind Dreams that grant, you know, sort of like Make-A-Wish organization for seniors. But that's funded by her kind of senior immersion tool, whose name just totally escaped me for some reason. It will come back to me. But you know, where you kind of, you know, you get the goggles and then you put the gloves on and you put things on your feet that mimic physically what it's like being a senior. But then you also put headphones on and you now have simulated the environment of what people are hearing. And then they throw you into a room and say, go do six chores. And you come out and you've done half of one. And I've asked the group, I said, how many of you have been through any of that? 5%. How many of you have an advanced directive? A medical power of attorney, 5%. These are people who work with memory care people every day and their family caregivers, and they're not immersed in who these people are and what they're going through or how you prepare and tell others and educate your communities about how you prepare. And I really left there kind of bothered that there was not more there were not more people who had been more immersed in what it was they're doing, because, you know, in healthcare, it's so siloed and people are so laser focused on what they do that they sometimes lose track of the big picture. I was telling a group yesterday that, you know, my mother recently passed, but her last surgery she had a small bowel obstruction, not to get gross about it, but basically they have to cut a piece of your intestines and sew you back together, which she survived the operation at 94. But, you know, the surgeon came out afterwards and told my wife, oh, it went great, you know, because from his perspective, it did go great. He did what he had to do surgically. You know, he's like, you know, a contractor almost, you know, let me put her back together. The anesthesiologist came out and said, oh my goodness, we had to pump so much oxygen into her. It's a lucky we didn't lose her. She almost coded. Her rehab's going to be really, really hard. And this was in a hospital system that was really known for its kind of patient experience. But I told the group yesterday, I said, I didn't even know if these guys were in the same operating room together when they came out. So, you know, long story short is that I'm trying to show healthcare organizations when I'm working with them on a consulting basis, trying to make money to fund my advocacy, that they have to think of the big picture, and that when they think of getting involved in the communities and looking at social determinants of healthcare, that there's going to be benefits to their organization, not just from a marketing standpoint, but they're going to start impacting, you know, the metrics that they get rewarded for or punished for. You know, the big one in healthcare, hospital healthcare right now is readmissions. And yet, you know, 1 in 7 Alzheimer's hospitalizations are unnecessary. And that's a combination of long-term care facilities who, you know, because of liability issues and other issues, first signs of trouble, they're taking people to the emergency department, and emergency departments that are not trained in dementia, and somebody acts out and they have no surrogate or caregiver there, they call the cops before they find out that the person actually has dementia and just needs to be treated with some compassion and empathy. So while they may be clinically excellent in their focused areas, there's few people out there trying to connect the dots. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think my role as a messenger and connecting the dots is probably the biggest thing I can bring to healthcare and also to anybody who's thinking about aging issues.
You mentioned dementia, and that's something very close to our heart. We did a project with that here a couple of years ago, and I'll try to keep these pieces short because I really want to know your opinion of what can be done about this. We took people's vocal prints and were able to determine whether they had dementia, and there were several things that were common in their vocal prints, and that's what we work on, that people who have the same issues have the same vocal anomalies. But we were able to help people get their sense of smell back, which comes with Parkinson's. We'd help able to help them walk better. We had people being able to do their crossword puzzles again. And we started looking at the architecture in the voice. We did Robin Williams' voice just as a control because it was before anything came up about him having Parkinson's, and now they've discovered it's Lewy protein. We could see in his voice several years beforehand that he had these high Lewy proteins in his vocal print. And the day he died, I think it was the day after, it doesn't matter, I went on a national radio show, and they said, oh, it's depression, it's so bad. I said, I don't think so. I think he had some form of dementia that dealt with Lewy protein. And boy, they just poo-pooed that idea. And so the next day, his wife came out with the fact that he had Parkinson's dementia. And we've done big projects with that. We have software ready and waiting, and we have been able to reverse it and looking at choline and zinc and different kinds of medications and what they do just with frequencies. So I think this is probably, you've talked about a lot, probably the biggest one on your mind. How could we provide our software, train people, and we do it for free, to these hospitals so that these people could be tested to see what they really need in comparison to the projects we've already done and reversed?
Yeah, and that's a good question. And I was jotting notes down as you were talking about this. And, you know, there's a few things that came to mind with me when you were speaking. And one thing is coordination of care. And again, getting back to silos in healthcare. And there are so many different organizations that are doing different things, and I don't think there's any one body that's trying to coordinate all that is out there to help people, you know, with diagnosis and then with, you know, getting people into, you know, support systems and things like that. So, you know, one of the roadblocks I always see is that there's coordination issues. And even when I show a slide of the long-term care continuum of care to my audiences, and, you know, it starts from aging in place to skilled nursing and hospice and home health. And I said, each of these organizations have their own separate associations, long-term care associations. There's two or three of them. Some of them say one represents the for-profits and the other non-profit, and they all have their own agendas. And sometimes it's just hard to break out of that. So that's one roadblock I see. Hospitals, there's a friend of mine, Gary LeBlanc. He has something called the Hospital Wristband Program, and it's supposed to encourage hospitals to identify dementia, sooner, or at least at admission. If somebody has a known diagnosis, then they put a purple wristband on them and the symbol of Alzheimer's, or they put it on the door or both, and educate. You know, they do training with the staff to kind of educate them around some of this. But he proposes to do like a mini COG test on admission. Not as a definitive diagnosis of dementia, but as a marker that maybe something's going on here. We need to be more empathetic. And he's facing a lot of resistance to that idea because of possibly people thinking that you are trying to diagnose my loved one with this disease. And so all this to say is hospitals are hard places to crack. And the number one thing that's going to convince them is a whole body of evidence, studies, you know, clinical studies, white papers that absolutely show this. And it sounds amazing. I would love to know more myself that shows this is something that can then help determine if somebody has some form of dementia, and actually through the interventions you use can actually reverse it. But I think that's one thing and that hospitals might pay attention to. And I've done some work with the Cleveland Clinic, and they're very involved in these areas and certainly can help make some connections that way. But I just think there's so many silos, so many competing agendas, so many voices. I mean, we just hear it in our pop culture with elections and all this. There's so much noise that trying to break through is hard. And I think you need a combination of real metrics and data with some, you know, savvy in marketing as our new president-elect obviously has shown seems to work.
I wanted to redirect this slightly, and I'll do this by a short story. This is in the category of patient experience, which is not a phrase I've heard a lot in this realm of aging and facilities and that actual patient experience. And I say that from actual experience of about 3 years ago, I had 30 hours of surgeries back to back. And I was in a healthcare facility for a year. And I was in a facility that had three people to a room with curtains in between, and it held about 275 people. I was, except during the surgeries where I was drugged into oblivion or in post-traumatic, you know, stress from the surgery. I don't mean the surgeries are bad. Well, I mean, they were serious, but they were like, you know, that part. But the rest of the time, I'm who I am now in terms of cognitive and talking and, you know, this thing. I'm a radio guy. It was really stunning. Up until that time, I'd never had a critical illness. I mean, I'd, you know, broken things and had things fixed. But it was really stunning to me. I have other words, but we're on air, so I can't use them. How I felt like a cog in a wheel, and it was just a machine to make money off of me. You know, I was not in a hospital facility. I was in a care facility. And I mean, the staff was, and the nurse, you know, like the nurse, the head of the nurse station and all those workers were as kind as they possibly could be. But the management had them stretched out so far, and they were individually managing so many people that they never actually had time to do much care, even if they did care. And this was in a system of a doctor who owned about four or five facilities. He had, you know, a staff of, you know, workers under him, doctors who would come in and visit and do the procedures of checking people, you know, doing stuff and checking them and checking their results and guiding them to what the next step was. But the rest of the time, you just felt like the interaction was as brief as possible because management was always pushing them to get to the next person. You felt like you were in a factory.
Yeah.
And how does that, is there a way to get that part of the system to change? I mean, I understand there is a, we need to, you know, make a certain amount of money and we all have to have businesses and all this, but it just felt, I can't come up with a better word than inhuman. I mean, it just felt like you were in a factory and having a stamp put on, but here you are with a variety of people who are in various states of either dis-ease of one kind or another, post older surgery. There weren't many young people. And or people who were in transition. In my year, I had four roommates that died.
Oh, my.
How do we, is there a way we can get that changed? I mean, and I know part of it is your work of getting people involved in being caregivers and involved and educated about part of that. But is there a way to begin to chink away at changing that part of the system?
Well, you know, the unfortunate part is the only chink, as you say, is the cha-ching of money, and unfortunately, and until you can show, so yesterday I showed a video. It's actually from the LA Times. I found it, and it's called The Singing Nurse, and they basically documented this gentleman who's the nurse in a hospital, and how he was singing for the particularly this one patient, and what a incredible difference it made in her care. And, you know, went on to explain that when he does this, the people feel better, they feel less need for medications and things like that. And so it actually helps, you know, clinically. And then there's a better connection between people. And after I get done showing the video, I say, you know, did it really cost him any more time than he would have spent doing what he did? But look how much more personal it was. And, you know, I think with hospital administrators, with long-term care administrators, you know, they think this patient or resident experience is just simply, you know, smile and be happy program. And it's not the program of the day. It really impacts every aspect of healthcare. The experience is everything. I talk about how my mother was in the hospital when she was 88 and, you know, with a life-threatening operation, which she came through. But the day before, when she was fine and cleared, she was in her room. And, you know, my sister and I had disappeared down to the cafeteria. And somebody from patient finance came in and, you know, verbally pounced on her about how she was going to pay her bill, you know, when she was contemplating whether I'm going to be alive the next day. And so there's so many other ways of doing this. And part of it is understanding, you know, it's a culture thing. For administration to act, first of all, I think you have to figure out a way to show them that when you do these things, when you're more empathetic, I'll tell you about my mother and her first doctor visit in North Carolina in a second, but when you do these things, when you get involved in the community with Dementia Friendly, you're actually going to create a healthier community that's going to result in better outcomes and actually hit your bottom line in some way, shape, or form. And until you make the financial connection, it's hard for them to get on board with some of these things. So I think that's an obstacle. But, you know, I think you also, you know, I show three slides and make three different points when I talk about this in my presentations. And one of them is I show a brochure of a long-term care facility. It says, death and dying operational guidelines in long-term care. And first of all, people chuckle because, you know, well, they have operational guidelines around that. And I said, well, here's the funnier part. The guy who put it on Flickr, this photo sharing site, put a quote, said, so if you die in a long-term care facility and you get it wrong, do you have to die all over again? And, you know, and the point is that we get so wrapped up in our regulations and rules that, and some of it is necessary because we are talking life and death, but not everything in healthcare is life and death on the line. And so if we step back and just can simplify a little bit, you know, we finally have a different perspective. Or I tell an age-old story of, you know, I show a picture of an environmental services employee, you know, cleaning the floor, and I ask them, you know, what's his job? And they say, you know, just what I said. And then I show a picture of the logo from NASA. And I say, you know, in the context of NASA and the 60s and a certain president tasking us to do something, what was his job? And, you know, I got, you know, you have millennial audiences now, so it gets a little harder to make those connections from the past. But some people get it, and basically it was to put a man on the moon. And this, the engineer got it, that at the end of the day, if the floor wasn't clean, the proverbial banana peel was on the floor, and an engineer slipped, he was going to jeopardize the mission. So culturally, how do you have your organization look at you know, the connection between what it is you do, no matter if you're in the furthest back room of the building? And I can give you case studies of how billing, and I just told you one about my mother, how billing impacts the experience of care. And I would contend that even how hospitals bill or come after you to collect can actually cause health problems. And I think you need to show the bigger picture of what it is you're trying to, you know, to achieve. And, you know, I'll just say sometimes spending that extra time with the patient, you know, you can actually show a financial equivalent to that. So, you know, when my mother first came to Carolinas, because my sister had passed away, and this was, you know, back in 14, and we took her to her first doctor appointment, and she, you know, we had all the medical records up there, and you know, to his credit, he reviewed all of them and came in prepared. And, you know, we talked about her health for a little bit, but then, you know, I tell people it was remarkable, because I still do believe it was remarkable. He pulled up a stool next to her and basically looked her in the eye and said, "Tell me what's going on." And for 45 minutes, they had a conversation that to do with her medical and more to do with her life. You know, she just lost her daughter, her firstborn. You know, she had friends in Florida that she essentially was now being ripped away from to move to North Carolina. She was in an independent living community. She had to make friends. And, you know, this went on for 45 minutes. And, you know, my wife and I kind of slinked back and blended into the wall because we were just so, you know, taken aback by all of it and just didn't know how to deal with it. You know, at the end of it all, the doctor said, "Listen, I want you to go back to that community. I want you to grieve. I want you to have fun and come back in 30 days and we'll talk about your health care." And, you know, it was so remarkable to me. He took the time to listen. And we so don't do that in healthcare. And, you know, I answer people's questions that's already in their mind before I have the opportunity to let them ask it, is that, how can he do that with every patient? I said, you know, here's what I think why he can do that, is that when my mother was in Florida, essentially, she was being shuffled off to doctors. You know, every time I would call my sister, "Where are you at?" "I'm at this specialist. I'm at this doctor. I'm at here." With her doctor here in the Carolinas, he saw her, maybe once every couple of months. She went to no specialist here. She lived to be 94. The operation she had was in no way related to any of the other conditions that she had. You know, I would say that she got better health care through more personalized healthcare and his ability to maybe probably see more patients because he was seeing them longer, but for fewer times in the healthcare system. And it got to a point where she was complaining to me that she didn't think she was getting the healthcare she needed because in her mind, she wasn't going to the doctor frequently enough. Mm. And in reality, she was, you know, getting what I thought, of course, I'm the son and the sons are not always right. You know, an appropriate amount of healthcare. But again, it came down to just like that example that I gave you of the doctors, the surgeon and the anesthesiologist. You know, the second part of that story in the same hospitalization for my mother was when the surgical intern came in and, you know, took a look at my mother's stitches and you know, pronounced her good to go, as in even thinking, well, she could leave the hospital now. And the nurse said, you know, she just had a heart attack about 3 days ago, and we're actually preparing to transport her to hospice care. And again, it's like, this is a healthcare system that actually is known for its devotion to patient experience, trains around it, hires around it, does patient huddles in the morning, you know, to talk about cases and handoffs and all this kind of stuff. But sometimes the simplest things of talking to each other and not just passing each other in the hallway, can make the biggest difference. So there was a study recently that showed that 20% of people, seniors, leave hospitals with unstable vital signs. I mean, how do you have that happen? And they said, you know, a lot of the algorithms around readmission rates, don't point to the fact that if you just paid attention with your senses or use those simple instruments that we use for everybody and taking your blood pressure, listen to your heart, you would find these things out, not relying on algorithms to tell you whether this person's a risk for readmission. So sometimes we just, we don't use common sense. That's a pretty long answer, but I think you have to connect it financially, first of all, to make anybody act on anything. Then you have to connect it culturally and do it over time. We like to say stealth mode, so that that you build this culture where it's okay to listen. It's okay to do things for the patient, like sing to them without feeling that you're going to get fired because you're doing something that's out of protocol. I mean, I'm sure that nurse, is in an environment culturally where he's allowed, he can do that. And not all organizations are that way, because we tend to be very rigid, and we are some solutions for some organizations are we'll script our staff on what to say and how to say it, and it becomes really artificial and people see through it.
Well, I would also toss in, again, from my experience, that I had that very experience where one of the administrators of the facility came to me post-surgical and was giving me, insert word of your choice, attic, about a bill that needed to be paid. And fortunately for me, really a gift, and I cannot tout this is a positive experience part enough, is that I had a friend that was what now I would call being a patient advocate for me. And she was fierce. I mean, just, boy, up against, in your face, like cartoon character, up in the grid of their face, like, what the blank do you think you're doing? And why didn't you come to me? And, and that's a really huge thing for people to have as a patient advocate. In my case, she also had the durable power of attorney. So they couldn't say, oh, I can't talk to you because you're not. She was like, no, I am, you blank blank. And
yep.
What the heck do you think you're doing? And why, that's an amazing thing to have somebody, particularly when you're in a health situation, when you're in a crisis or post-crisis, to have somebody that you can turn to and say, help me. And they will go, I don't say necessarily fight the battle, but at least stand with pain. Because sometimes when you're post-operation or in some slightly altered state, or just traumatized from what's...
You're not thinking correctly, yeah.
You're not thinking, able to think clearly, because you're like, look, I broke my leg, and you want to talk to me about what?
Exactly.
So to have a friend, relative, something, whatever that category would be called, to advocate for you, or just to be a filter, just for you to be able to text them or call them, now text them, or have them be around where you can just say, could you help me with this? And they come over and boy, she, as I said, in my case, she was fierce about protecting me.
Unleash the hounds.
Annoying, like, well, why are you doing that? The pillows are ugly. Not that, but truly like, what do you think you're doing? Why are you giving him that medication? What's not arguing so much as like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And that's a powerful thing to have.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And a good friend of mine is a woman named Tricia Torrey, and she actually changed professions and started the Association of Patient Care Advocates. And she was likewise the About.com patient care advocate expert for a time. And, she has a whole organization of people who, kind of do this for a living. But her her pursuit of this came because she was misdiagnosed with cancer and was one day away from starting like chemo or radiation or something. And they, you know, it's not that. And, you know, it changed her life, obviously, and it changed her profession. And so I absolutely agree with you, especially in this convoluted healthcare, society that we have, in which, you know, the communication within organizations, let alone between and amongst organizations or even amongst departments and hospitals, is, you know, is crazy. And then you get into that post care. You need somebody to advocate for you. There's other kind of specialties where they'll come and they'll scrutinize every line of your bill, and they'll go to bat for you there and take a percentage of what you save, and probably, you know, well worth it. There's also, as I'm sure you know, geriatric care managers as a profession that has kind of creeped up in the last maybe 10, 15 years. And that is maybe a more broadly focused position, more narrowly focused in that it deals with seniors, but more focused generally in that it could be all kinds of coordination of care for mom or dad. And that's important, especially in a society where, you know, maybe the close-knit urban families that I grew up in Philly, everybody kind of disperses and you don't have a network in place close by. So I agree there's groups of professions that somehow you probably look and say, boy, there was a time we didn't need them, and it was a simpler time. And even I can remember as a kid having physicians make house calls. And but it's just gotten so complex. And, I frankly, you know, not to editorialize a whole lot, but I frankly fear what's going to happen with our healthcare system, given the state of the election results. I think it's going to not be really the best of scenarios, not just in healthcare, but for senior care. And then some of those social things, I've been reading things about, you know, Meals on Wheels and these social programs that might, you know, have to take an axe because they want to do tax cuts in other places. So, you know, you need advocates, you need people to keep these issues alive and to talk about them, because, this isn't going away. The society is getting older. The number of family caregivers are growing. The number of caregivers in the workplace is 6 out of 10, and 25% of those are millennials. And so this is a huge issue, taking care of all these people.
And how do we, I almost thought about the byline of this show. This sounds so much darker than it is, but I mean, it's really, you know, none of us is going to get out of this alive. And it's real. I don't mean that as like a dun dun dun. It's just the real thing. You know, the millennials, the 20-year-olds. Eventually, it comes to a point where we're not going to get out of this alive. So I really like your work and the direction, you know, that you're moving. I really, this wasn't my direct question, but it pops up again, and I have to say it. But I really like that you're really such an advocate for putting the care into healthcare. Because as you say, particularly with this current election thing, it seems like it's become possibly more tricky because of, as you say, cuts and potentials of what could occur. And I think people in your work, it seems like you're really also trying to engage people in wanting to be part of that patient caregiver. I don't mean directly caring for necessarily, but at least being involved. Work educating people, trying to get them to like, come on, we have to actually take care of each other eventually.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's certainly part of it. And one of the things I do actively is try to, you know, become a voice for the family caregiver, because, there are studies that show only 1 in 3 doctors ask a family caregiver for their input. Only 1 in 6 ask the family caregiver how they're doing themselves. And, you know, when my doctor, who is now the same doctor my mother went to because I was so impressed with him, asked me to come back after my physical last year, and I balked because I'm in pretty good shape and I exercise regularly, he says, no, you're a caregiver. And you know, my mother, God rest her soul and God love her, I mean, she's a tough Italian broad, you know, Catholic, and had all her marbles. She had no dementia. And so, you know, I got to run for my money as a caregiver. and I was stressed, and he recognized that stress and said, you need to come back and see me, and we need to monitor this. And I think, you know, the care of the caregiver, just in terms of, are they able to, you know, execute their caregiving duties as a family caregiver? So, you know, there's one thing getting involved, and then there's the other, are you prepared to get involved? And sometimes you have no choice but to get involved, but you have to know when you are that you have to take care of yourself and you have to balance your life. And, you know, I have the, you know, at least the, I can look back now, it's only been since June 2nd that she passed, but, you know, you kind of reflect on the whole 2.5 years of being a caregiver. And, you know, I beat myself up a lot during that time, but I think I can say with some degree of confidence that all in all, I did everything I possibly could and I balanced it all out. And I think, you know, it was all good. And so, yeah, I do believe that people need to become more involved. But, you know, the other burning thing that I have that people need to start talking about and thinking about, and this goes back to that, you know, the Still Alice movie, when we told our friends that we were going to go see this, nobody wanted any parts of that because nobody wanted to see themselves as that, as you know, which is part of that. None of us are getting out of here alive. It's like in a continuing care retirement community where there's independent living and there's assisted living in nursing homes. And you find that it's very rare that the independent living folks will go down and kind of mingle with the other levels of care because they see themselves there. And I'm trying to, so against that backdrop, I'm trying to help people understand that you need to prepare for your aging much sooner in life. You need to understand that how you take care of yourself physically is going to impact how you age. You know, I go into a lot of nursing homes where I tell people that age didn't catch up with people. They didn't keep up with themselves. And so there's a responsibility there. There's a financial responsibility to start saving and preparing because, you know, our society did a good job of now getting people to save in a 401k and those types of instruments. But, you know, people are putting money in them to save for what they think is going to be the European vacation, you know, when they retire, when in reality, it might be paying for some of their healthcare costs. And so, you know, not everyone is as wise as my wife, who at, believe it or not, at 38 years old, bought as a voluntary benefit from her company, a long-term care insurance policy. She still has it to this day. She never lapsed. And if, you know, her premiums are so ridiculously low that people can't even believe it when I tell them, and she has inflation riders and all this kind of stuff. She's going to be in the nursing home in the assisted living with, you know, the gold trim. And I'm going to be in the poorhouse down the block because while she says at the time she tried to get me to buy long-term care insurance, I don't think we were married at the time. I wasn't involved as much in senior care and I was just being cheap. So if I go to the market and buy it now, I can't even imagine. I know what I will pay. And so that's kind of number two. And the number three is I tell people you have to, you know, emotionally prepare for aging. And that's kind of where the book comes in and where some of the more inspirational keynotes I do come in, because I really try to convey what have I learned from elders about living a quality life in the places that most people associate with death. And I make points about, you know, they still have purpose of some sort. They still have a social network. They, you know, are lifelong learners. They have a sense of humor. You know, and there's like 8 points I make. And, you know, probably one of the most important ones I make is that they have gratitude, that no matter what their circumstance, you know, and I've seen people in the worst physical circumstance you can imagine who, if I'm performing at the place, that you would never know it by their personality. And so we have so much to learn about how you can age with a quality of life, but we need to do it sooner. And some of that, you know, in society where sometimes, you know, I have all of our grandkids are kind of dispersed now. We have 6, but 4 of them are in Philly. And that's not too hard to get to on a regular basis, but, you know, 2 are in San Diego. So when you have a society where you don't have the grandparents as close as you maybe had when I was growing up, you need to expose people to elders. And that's why you find in Cleveland, there's an intergenerational charter school. And, you know, you look at programs like that where the kids as part of their curriculum are actually interacting with elders. And so, you know, this whole thing is, you know, yeah, we're none of us are going to get out of alive, and most of it are going to get old. So, and then most of us are going to wear a caregiver hat at some point. And so, as much as nobody wants to deal with it until it becomes a crisis, which is still pretty much the way it goes 80% of the time, there's very few proactive out there doing these types of things. That's what you really have to start thinking about.
And I'm surprised to find, actually stunned, that we're coming up toward the end of the show. How do you work with people one-on-one, or is it mostly you direct people toward looking at, you know, some of your products and your consulting, and, you know, there's a lot of information on your theagingexperience.com. Is that where you direct people, or do you actually give classes for people to learn how to be a caregiver going off of your, and I have to jump in and say, I highly recommend everybody read the Who Moved My Dentures, because it's a good story. Well, I mean, it's the great title. It's a great title to have laying around in your coffee table, I can tell you from experience. And it's, you know, it's got humor, but it's really, you know, people need to be reading this in college in a certain way. Like, you know, let's start introducing the idea that we're really going to get older earlier, so by that when we get there, it's not like, oh my God, you know, it's, so how do people work with you? Where do we?
Yeah. I mean, really there's kind of three buckets. So no, I don't necessarily hang out a consumer shingle. You know, I guess where the most consumer directed is, yeah, go to my products on my website. And obviously I have the book. I do have a couple other things that are kind of interesting. I have that are directly to the consumer. I have something called a 30-day video caregiving series. And essentially, when you sign up for that, and I did it with another company, so you actually buy it through another company, but I produced it with them. Essentially, you'll get a message a day for 30 days that can guide people in their caregiving journey. It's part inspirational. It's part educational. You're listening to beautiful kind of spa-like music in the background and looking at beautiful images that kind of float by on the screen. And it's kind of like your moment of zen in your morning of caregiving. And if there are people who know caregivers who can use a boost, they can certainly gift them this program. I also think, you know, that hospices and home health care, anywhere there where the family caregiver is under stress or you've identified caregivers under stress, these can make good gifts. I also have, you know, the CDs that I use in my nursing homes that are available for the public, but I also have activity guides that nursing homes and assisted living can buy along with the CDs. And, you know, one of the unique things I'm doing out of my music studio is I can actually stream concerts out of here, either to organizations or really where it makes the most impact is one-on-one. So if somebody wanted to gift a concert to a loved one who's homebound, you know, they tell me a little bit about the person, the kind of music they like, and you know, at a certain time we tune in and I have a conversation with them and entertain them. Now, even if they're not computer savvy or don't even have a device, make it an intergenerational program with a local school or if you're, you know, the grandkids or great grandkids are around. So I would say they're my consumer, you know, pieces that I have. Obviously, on a consulting basis, it is more specific to healthcare organizations around a few things, patient experience, strategic marketing, and really kind of this new push now, how do you become dementia friendly? And so I'm really trying to distinguish myself in that way. And with the, you know, kind of unique perspective of being involved in all aspects of care, I'm not just the guy who worked in hospitals or long-term care. I had this kind of full perspective, but you know, I have to tell you, frankly, that I get the most fulfillment as a professional speaker because I can reach more people, you know, and in an hour with a message than maybe, you know, doing a consulting gig where, you know, you leave a document behind that says you should do this, that, or this, and sometimes it just takes, you know, goes on a shelf somewhere. So, you know, if I had my druthers, frankly, and this is an open call. You know, I would love to have a corporate sponsor who would sponsor. I have something I take around called the Caregiver Smile Tour, and it's been, you know, I make those points that I learned from elders, and it's really an uplifting program. And I think I can impact people, you know, greatly that way, and also through my media work. The media work I do now, is frankly not monetized, and I think if I get to a different level, it would be. But I do a lot of TV work locally with a Charlotte Today program, and so I think some savvy corporate sponsor would see the package that I have and utilize me. I could probably reach a lot more people. So you could probably understand why I have three separate websites at one time, and I'm trying to narrow that down into this one with this kind of all-encompassing mission, which does sometimes, as you kind of pointed out at the top of the show, and now, how do you make your money? And so I appreciate you asking me so that I could clarify that.
Well, we were out of time. We certainly appreciate your being here. I think we all need your wisdom and patience and passion that seems to be uniquely combined in what you do. So thank you for being here.
Well, thanks to the both of you for finding me and reaching out to me. And I look forward to working with you again in the future.
Well, if you ever have more to say, another book, let us know.
I will do that.
Thank you so much, Anthony. That was really great.
I will be in touch behind the scenes.
Okay, great, Sherry. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Anthony.
All right, you guys have a good day.
You too. Thanks very much.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, well, I know you're going to want to tell your friends about that. He was just filled with information, and his site, theagingexperience.com, has a lot of really good information. He does on his blog side. He has a lot of videos that he does. Either he's singing songs, and he's a good singer. And information, just thoughts that he's having about the aging experience as he's really discussing, putting the care back in healthcare. I know that sounds cheesy, but it's really true. Really wanting us to have a good aging experience. And being in that category, I'm for that. So everybody have a great rest of the week, and we'll see you all on Tuesday. All right. Bye-bye.